That's actually really close.
That's pretty good for someone not a Star Trek fan.
That's not bad. Although we already have theme music, so you just screwed this all up.
Just give us our start date.
Guys, it's star date 95353.19.
Of course.
And you are listening to Star Trek Discovery Pod, a permanent record Star Trek podcast. So today, we're discussing the third episode of Star Trek Discovery. Context is for kings.
Context is king, baby.
It's four kings.
It's four kings.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
And universal laws are for losers.
Oh, I like that one.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Why do you look at me?
Just side-eye right at you. My name is Mike. I'm the enthusiastic but still somewhat critical Star Trek fan. With me is...
I'm Clyde. I am the cool fan who actually turns out to be more of a Star Trek geek than I thought I was.
You're totally cool. I'm Grant, and I don't know anything about Star Trek, so this is a new experience for me.
You're discovering Star Trek, would you say?
This is my own Star Trek discovery. Yeah,
very good.
It's terrible.
And Ashley is not with us today. We wish her well on her away mission. She'll probably be back with us next week. Hat tip to Ashley.
Away mission.
Yeah.
I love that you scripted that out.
I just hope she's not wearing a red shirt.
We will say that she's on an away mission.
I like
you push your geek glasses more toward your face.
I like that you always call out the fact that I'm reading, you know, whenever I'm talking. Like, I sound really natural. And then Grant's like, are you going to read all that?
Are you ever just going to talk to us, Mike?
look up. All right. So before we dive into the episode discussion, which I can't wait. I mean, this was a really good episode. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone to visit us at StarTrekPod.com. You can subscribe to the podcast there. Click the Apple iTunes link to rate and review us. If you give us a 5-star review, we'll read it on a podcast. And if you listen to this episode and you say to yourself, hey, I like these guys. I want to listen to them babble on about Star Trek, like, a lot more.
They're all saying that. They're like, man, I wish this party would never stop.
If you don't want this nerd party to stop, you can visit us at patreon.com/StarTrekPod, where you'll find bonus Star Trek podcasts. All you have to do is sign up to support us. $1 an episode.
That's like $4 a month, guys.
Yeah.
Pony up.
Yeah.
Because you love this, and we're giving you bonus exclusive content.
And you can listen to all that at patreon.com/StarTrekPod.
I say pony up like I'm going to bully them into giving us money.
Give us your lunch money, kids.
Grant the Enforcer.
Yeah, you're like Section 31.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
You get a black badge.
Oh, yeah.
There you I was go. Paying attention.
Hot. That was so hot.
It was hot? That's a weird thing. That was hot. I'm learning more about you Trekkies.
Wow. Clyde's the cool fan, everybody.
I thought I was until about last week.
He's got the sexy sweats for these black badges.
I thought I was just like, wow, you know, I enjoy it. I'm your everyday fan who's not too deep. And then I realized, no, I'm all the way deep down in the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Oh, nice reference there, too. Uh-huh,
uh-huh. That's what I'm saying.
All right. So let's jump into our first hot takes about this episode. Episode 3, Context is for Kings. I think this episode did so many things right. I absolutely loved it. It followed up on the fallout for our main character beautifully, and it set up her new role going forward really well. It introduced us to this new cast, not the entire cast, but a lot of them. A new ship, a new story arc in such a compelling and intriguing way. I was pleased with the pacing of this episode. It was really like calm and deliberate, and it managed to give these new characters room to breathe, so you kind of get a good feel for them. You know, it wasn't like the first two episodes were good, but they were just so fast-paced. I like that this was a calm, even though it did kind of turn into a horror movie for a while, but it was still, it had a really nice, assured pace to it. There were technobabble scenes here, but they were like really compelling and kind of fun to listen to, which isn't necessarily always the case in Star Trek. And I like that it set up this really nerdy mystery plot that's based in science. I thought that was very, very Star Trek. It was really good. Captain Lorca was great. Jason Isaacs. probably my favorite new character. I think this episode did everything right. And by the end of it, I was like, this is what I want from this show. It's establishing its long form story arc, but it was also a good standalone episode. It told its own good story while setting off a long-term story we're going to be watching for a number of episodes. Grant, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm on board with this. I mean, I was already on board, but I think episode three really gives us a look at what this show is going to be. This is now our crew. This is our day-to-day. It's interesting because this is 15 episodes in this season, and our typical TV season is now 13 in the U.S., so what we're getting is 13 episodes of regular season plus what seems to be more like a two-hour prologue that they shot for us, like a mini-movie.
I thought the same thing.
And like some people who took a little bit of issue with those first two episodes, I mean, I think it makes sense that they booked those episodes back-to-back in the first week as it's similar to like Battlestar Galactica, how they had that movie premiere.
The miniseries.
Yeah, and then they got in with episode like 33 minutes or whatever and going forward. Like, then you get a feel for what the show's going to be, but you are opened up to this world, and they set the stage in a really fun way, I thought, with those first two episodes. This one, I'm loving the cast of characters. It was great to see Saru again, to be introduced to Tilly and Stamens and Lorca. These are all really fun characters. The plot, how they brought in Burnham and really like took 6 months' time to like make her pay her dues, and then like bring her in what felt like a pretty fluid manner, and we are in wartime now. Like I bought into everything. I really enjoyed this episode, and I'm so excited for next week's episode as a result.
Guys, Grant's excited about Star Trek.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I love good TV.
Right.
And this
right.
is good TV.
But this is not only good TV. Like, I completely agree with that. It's really well done, well paced, well written television and well plotted, but it's also good Star Trek.
It is.
There are so many things that are making it good Star Trek.
See, that's interesting, but that's not the frame of reference I have.
But right. it's also very different Star Trek, yeah. right? It's not the same thing. They didn't just reboot something and give us the same thing. It's very unique.
This ain't your grandma's Star Trek.
No. Look, I loved it. Though I have to say, at the end of this episode, I was pretty pissed. Right, like I was upset, and I was like, ah. And my wife was trying to, she was trying to figure out, why are you so upset? And I was like, I'm mad because there's not more. Like, this is a series that I would love to binge. I mean, that's how into it I was.
So you went from aroused to angry.
Pretty much. I mean, that's kind of how I get down. So, no, but I thought this was a great episode from the very first scene all the way through. One of the things that I noticed is that I was completely in. Like, at no point as the episode was going, was I thinking about something else, or it didn't lose me at all. And that's so rare, right? You're watching something and you're thinking about the grocery list, or, oh, I got to do this tomorrow. But while it was on and I didn't want to miss a minute, I was fully engaged. And I thought that was the mark of something that's done really well. And Grant, to your point, as I was watching it and thinking about what I was seeing, I realized, I was like, this does remind me of Battlestar Galactica. And I was like, wow, to say that, that's pretty heavy.
Is that high praise?
It is. It's very high praise. And to think about the fact that they set it up, the first two episodes are kind of this standalone kind of mini series. And now we're getting into understanding who the characters were. I love the fact that we saw, you know, everybody called her the redheaded ensign. Her name is Kayla now. We kind of know that.
Is that Tilly?
Tilly.
No. There's another one. The one she's got the Shenzhou, right?
The cyberpunk chick.
Yeah.
All these redheads on this ship.
Yeah. I like it.
So we got to see that. So when I got home after our podcast last week, my wife was like, she was upset. She was like, we never got to meet all the characters. And I was like, let's wait. I think we're gonna see them. And it turns out we did get to see who some of them were. And one of the things that I love as we talk about Battlestar Galactica was Landry, the chief of security. She's from Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
And I was like, oh,
she's okay. Good.
She is good. Yeah. And so I was pretty impressed. I thought that there were some moments in there when they were on the way mission. I kind of caught myself going, all right, who's not making it back to the ship?
Yeah. Yeah.
But all
you're
in
dead
all,
and you might be dead.
Yeah. I was like, Tilly, I'm pretty confident she's going to make it back, but you know, random guy with a gun who we haven't seen, you might as well be wearing a red shirt. All in all, I was really impressed. Surprised that I am surprised that this is good. Like, I've been expecting kind of a downturn a little bit, but no, like, we're still elevating as we get to episode, and I can't wait to see the next one.
But you ended it unfulfilled, angry.
Just because I wanted more. And
it left you with blue tribbles.
Yes.
As Clyde contemplates his blue tribbles, there's so much of what you said that I agree with and I want to dive into. The first thing I want to dive into is you comparing this to Battlestar. And I'm not necessarily comparing it like scene for scene or line by line or theme for theme to Battlestar, but I will say this. I have been waiting since Battlestar ended for the next Battlestar.
I'm with you.
It's been like almost a decade. And when Battlestar came out, it elevated what was going on the Sci-Fi Channel or Sci-Fi or Syfy, whatever they call it, right? It made that a destination channel for me. And every time they launched a new show, I'm like, okay, is this going to be like Battlestar? And it wasn't. There was Caprica. There was
terrible.
Ascension, The Expanse even. I like The Expanse.
Dark Matter, which I'm going It's nothing is like that.
Right. But now I feel after these first 3 hours, I think we've found the show that is good enough to take that baton and run with it. Like, this is as good or has the potential to be as good as that groundbreaking show, Battlestar.
So here's what was so fascinating to me about Battlestar, and I think you're going to see here. It was something that was transcendent, so it wasn't just sci-fi people, right? Like, everyone's watching this show, and you can bring it in, and it's this thing that just Trekkies, non-Trekkies, like, everybody can watch. I think that's what we're going to see with Discovery, is the people who watch this are going to be, like, Grant, first-time people into the Trek universe, and people who've been here forever. And I think that's exciting, and that is the mark of great television.
Yeah. And I think we have the perfect specimen here in Grant.
Hi.
Hello. Like, you're digging this, right? I'm digging it as a Star Trek fan, but you're, like you said, a fan of good TV, and you're already in.
I mean, that was super arrogant of me. I like only good television. But yeah, I'm fully on board with this. The storytelling, how it's set up, both the like long-running arc, we're in a war, we have a fallen and disgraced protagonist who you kind of want to reclaim that hero's role, that you have this mysterious element going on this like dark science ship, and like what exactly are they researching? Is what he told her like the whole truth? Obviously not, because Lorca's got a creepy room of dead aliens going on.
Gorn skulls.
Lorca's menagerie.
Yeah. Lorca's menagerie. His Island of Dr. Moreau, creepy skeletons and whatever.
Guys, I'll be in here with my Gorn skulls for the night.
Dissected tribbles. I mean, that's a creepy place. Like, it's kind of cool, I guess, but it's also pretty creepy.
I'm gonna go. Saru, you got the bridge. I'm gonna play with these tribble entrails for a while.
But seriously, like, this show is not your episode by episode trivial procedural going on here. This is a fascinating world that, I mean, it's one thing to, like, you know, the world of Star Trek's already established, but to jump back only 10 years and expect like it's going to be that interesting, like what they've been able to do is set up a whole new trajectory within this already established landscape, which I think is fascinating.
So you wanted to know why I feel it's good Star Trek.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So the name of this episode, Context is for Kings, that was referring to the fact that Lorca, as a captain, at first blush, and even by the time you get to the end of this episode and you see, like, his, what did you call it, Clyde? His, where he
menagerie.
Had, his menagerie. Like, that's weird. Picard doesn't have tribble entrails on his desk.
He's got that weird snuggle dungeon, though, you know, with all the pillows he's always inviting people into.
Well, that's what's so fascinating about this is there are so many different things.
Yes.
That you would think that if you do a prequel, and I think this is kind of where Enterprise failed, was you're really just looking for those things that you know and references to things that you already know exist. And here we're seeing a room that you've never seen on any other Star Trek ship before. And the details, the Easter eggs, are kind of crazy. Like, you talk about this menagerie, the Gorn skeleton that he has. We know that this takes place 10 years before TOS, and we know that they actually encounter Gorns for the first time in TOS. So Lorca, as a bad man as he is, he at least knows of them in some way. I mean, this, I can't wait to unravel
that
mystery.
That's interesting.
It is, yeah.
I didn't know that they first encounter him there.
Right. And this is a really great melding, the Lorca character. Like, this is also why it's good Star Trek. This is a great melding of a mysterious character you get on a lot of modern television shows with the greatness of what you respect from a Starfleet captain, like Picard. Picard and Sisko. Lorca's got all of that. He's in control. He's capable. And he seems like somebody that you want to follow, right? And he definitely seems like someone who's worthy of respect, who's worthy of that chair.
But, okay, here's going to be one of my first questions.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that protocol within Starfleet, the chain of command is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
You respect that code. But here we have the USS Discovery, this like island of misfit toys, it seems like, on this ship, where these people are kind of a hodgepodge of people that are best in their field, but begrudgingly, like, especially in the case of Stamets, but also with
Stamets.
Michael, they are begrudgingly on this ship, somewhat against their will. And that seems interesting to me, especially with that one exchange where he's like, you're going to go over onto that ship. And Stamets was like, no, I'm not. And defiant. Like,
right.
That defiance and the fact that he didn't like lay down the law, how dare you? Instead, it was just kind of like jokingly sparring with him until he got him to do what he said. That seems unique to this world, correct?
It is very unique. And that goes back to why I think they set this as a prequel, right? Because it's in wartime, so you're going to get a different story. You're going to get a different ship. A lot of what's going on here is justified by it's wartime.
And that, win at any cost.
And win at any cost. That's why Lorca has his carte blanche to do whatever he wants. Yeah, he can pluck Michael Burnham out of prison or on her way to prison because, hey, we're in wartime, and I think I need you, so I can do that.
Not to mention, the way he plucked her out, you kind of killed the pilot of that transport.
That was in the process. Hilarious. So, that was so dark. That was like a Game of Thrones moment.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. Like, he's like, I want Michael on my team, and if I got to kill the pilot, the no-name red shirt pilot, I'll do it. Like, it was kind of like, whoa, all right. So I was, from jump, I was kind of like, you got to watch this guy.
Okay, wait. Are you saying that he set up those bugs outside and then the pilot?
I mean, right? He had to.
I mean,
okay.
I was a little concerned by the fact that they're sitting there and it's like, we've got to do this right now or we're going to drift and it's urgent and everybody's moving real fast. She flies off into space, right? And then right then, like almost instantly, Discovery shows up. Like, it seemed a little convenient.
But Michael pointed out that while they were on transport to whatever prison island they were going to, that they took a turn midway, and that was before this alien thing like grabbed onto their ship. So it seems like they had already deviated paths. So it is possible they deviated paths, but then something started sucking the energy. She went out, and it's unfortunate that she just stayed on there, they probably could have taken care of the problem.
I'm unwilling to go where you're going and saying that Lorca is actually that dark that he did get her killed. But that first scene, we're talking about that first scene where Michael Burnham's on the transport. Not only was that so like, it just echoed a lot of the tone of Battlestar Galactica when people are talking about, you know, they're headed somewhere and they're just having their human talk, right? You don't get that a lot in Star Trek where the conversation is about something, but it feels very human. It feels like real people talking. And then that beautiful special effects shot of the tractor beam of the Discovery just holding the transport ship in that tractor beam. I don't think I've seen anything as beautiful in Star Trek.
It was super sexy when that they show the ship, the glory shot of that ship, like just panning around the whole thing. I was like, ooh.
Let's talk about the ship.
I mean, before we get to the ship, I want to go back to that scene because that was a special scene to me. Like, and the reason why I say it was a special scene is because I'm watching this and I'm wondering, are they going to start falling into your typical tropes, right? Because it's so easy for them to set it up so that the pilot flies off into space. Everybody's like, oh, you're Michael Burnham. And she's able to be the hero and save the day.
Mm-hmm.
But no. Like, she's trapped just like they are. And she doesn't do anything.
She doesn't even care. She's, like, despondent.
Right. And then Discovery comes in and saves her. And so it was interesting that they didn't put her as the hero in that situation from the beginning. And I like that.
Yeah, the character is on the road to a redemptive arc, but it's not your typical redemptive arc. You know, she's not really changing. She's just getting back to who she really is.
Right. And it's when I was thinking about this and thinking about, wow, we've got this prisoner who becomes an officer again. And there are two others that that it reminds me of from the Star Trek universe. And you've got Lieutenant Tom Paris and Ensign Ro Laren. And it reminded me, and I know Grant's eyes are just kind of glazing over right now.
What?
But it reminded me of Ro Laren, but it's different in the fact that Ro was always kind of rebellious and she stayed true to that. And I think likewise with Burnham, you're looking at someone who is a first officer, a great officer, and will ultimately stay true to that as well.
And that's what makes this good Star Trek. Another thing that makes this good Star Trek, because like I was talking about the episode name, Context is King. At the end of the episode, she confronts, Lorca brings her up to his ready room and says, okay, this is your new job. You're going to be here. And she thinks she has it all figured out. She's like, okay.
He wants a fall guy, basically.
Want a fall guy. You're developing an illegal biological weapon, and you think you can do it because it's wartime, and you're going to go against everything the Federation stands for and create this biological weapon that can have some terrible ramifications all across the universe.
And blame me.
And you're going to blame me. You want a fall guy, and you think that I will be okay with this because you see me as someone with flexible morals because of the mutiny that I started. You know what? You're wrong. And he cuts her right off and says, no, actually what we're doing is we're doing some really great optimistic Star Trek shit here. We're not building a weapon. We're building a great scientific progressive innovation.
We're building a monorail.
Yeah,
the future of transportation.
And that was so great. I'm so glad she was wrong. I'm so glad that the plot took this turn. That was not necessarily unexpected for me, but it was a nice surprise. What did you guys think about that reveal?
Yeah, you know, it immediately showed us that she wasn't going to be painted as this desperate character, but she doesn't have all the answers either. Like, everything is not as it seems to be, and we're going to learn and kind of discuss. I got to take a shot. No.
Are we going to discover something?
We're going to discover what's really going on as she figures it out as well. So,
right. I mean, I think it's easy to want to fall back on everything being optimistic, but I think there's still something nefarious going on the ship.
It's a good melding of both things.
I mean, the menagerie going on there with all these dead aliens seems a little weird.
If you had that in your house, Grant, I'd be like, yo, this dude is weird. Like, something's not right about him.
It's messed up.
It would make a lot of sense, though.
In my house, yeah.
How much time have you spent with him?
Just enough to know that I wouldn't be surprised if I found that in his house.
I have my kids in little pens. I don't let them out from
those poor children. Okay, so let's break down some of these characters.
Right. No, you talked about the ship. Is cool.
The ship first. Okay.
This might be the coolest, I don't want to say the coolest starship ever, but this is definitely the coolest Star Trek ship.
Dude, that flat design, you know, and it doesn't have curves. It's just so angular, so sleek. I love it.
I also feel like we're getting to see bits and pieces of the ship. It's like its own character, which I don't know that we've really had that as part of the Star Trek universe before.
That's very true.
Where the ship, it's its own character, and you want to see this character develop over time and see more and more of it. It felt like before in Star Trek, Like they had the bridge and there was like the transporter room and engineering. And then every once in a while they toss you into a new area of the ship and you'd be like, oh, that's kind of interesting. But it wasn't fully fleshed out. And this is something different.
There were two scenes in particular that I was struck by. The first one is like right in the beginning when they suck in the prison transport ship and they pull it into that little like force field wall into the
shuttle bay.
The tractor beam in the shuttle bay, yeah.
And I was like, okay, I know where that's located. I think that's kind of a neat little shot of that and I get a sense of the ship and its layout from that. But then right at the end, right after Lorca shows Michael the spore transportation device thing, the shot does this interesting like zoom out to show where in the ship that's located, and it pulls out and it's like along the two wings, like off the back of that central disc. I don't know how to explain this.
This is a smile of joy.
Okay, I just don't know how to properly articulate it, but
is it the nacelles?
Was it on nacelles? I don't think so.
Is that what it is?
Maybe not. Maybe not yet, because I think we might be too early for nacelles.
But I was like, okay, I now know where some of their most important scientific progress and discoveries going on within this USS Discovery. I said the word. I know. Drink.
Take a shot.
But I like that they kind of showed that. They zoomed out, and then they flipped around. Like, this ship obviously has a presence. It was hyped up. And it seems like it's living up to the hype. And I like that because it's like this state-of-the-art dark science vessel that was designed to be the absolute top of its game because we are in wartime and we need critical research here. The fact that this seems to be, I don't want to say light years ahead of, but it seems to be ahead of the look of like the original series Enterprise. Was that one called the Enterprise?
The original series?
Yeah, the original show. The original series was called Star Trek.
No, what was the ship called?
Enterprise.
The Enterprise, yeah.
And what's the generation one called then?
The Enterprise. It's a new Enterprise.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Speaking of which, when we talk about the ship, this is what, NCC 1301?
I believe so, yeah. I did write it down.
You guys,
what you just said now, you're like 5 minutes away from printing out like spec sheets of the Discovery and pinning them up on your wall, man.
No, here it is. NCC 1031 USS Discovery. I mean, that was a big moment. Like that shot across the kind of the call letters. That's big.
Yeah. That was a different big moment.
It's iconic for Star Trek. And so when you see that, this is the first time we saw those letters. You do want to know what they are, right?
You literally made your own captain's log in your pants when you saw that.
First captain's log joke. Only took three episodes. Very good.
I got a lot more of those jokes you guys are tired of.
I know you do. They're all going to come out.
But yes, the ship is a really cool character already established in this show. Yep. But we got also some other really cool characters.
Yeah. Well, before that, I do like that you mentioned that the ship seems kind of like, you know, a little more advanced or light years beyond like the other Enterprises we've seen or the other ships we've seen.
Yeah.
I think that would be a concern of a lot of Star Trek fans. You and I have probably seen that online, that, oh, the technology's too, you know, looks too futuristic. It doesn't look like Kirk's ship. But I think they've written, without it being too heavy-handed, a reason for that, right?
Because Kirk got a basic bottom-of-the-shelf ship.
Okay, well, not only is that canon, but it's... Did you guys hear about this new Star Trek novel?
No.
Yeah.
So it's a tie-in book for Discovery called Desperate Hours by David Mack, who apparently has written tons of great Star Trek books. And the novel tries to explain some of the disparities between maybe the costumes that we're seeing now and the costumes that we know are around in that era, based on like the pilot episode of the original series, The Cage. And basically, and it's kind of a hand wave, and I haven't read the book, so I'm sure hopefully it does establish it well. But it basically says that Discovery is a class of ship that is separated from a ship like the Enterprise. It's on its own mission. It's doing its own thing. It's in a special classification.
But it also seems to... It has Spock basically establish through a casual throwaway line when he steps onto one of these ships. He's like, huh, I'll never understand how these humans even decade to decade, love to reestablish their style. They seem so inconsistent. And it's true. Like, you can look at our design from the 60s versus the 70s versus the 80s versus 90s. It's all so distinct. We humans are constantly loving to redesign everything. So, yeah, starship to starship, these will look different. Costumes will be constantly shifted and upgraded because we love that shit. So it makes sense.
Well, I think the other point that really has hit home as I watch this is that the whole idea of wartime. For the most part, as we watch Star Trek, they're in peacetime. You've got this established Federation. These are all very much, the Enterprise is a science vessel, right? Its mission is to explore, right? Even when you look at the Next Generation and you've got this flagship, it's still a flagship science vessel. The thing about Discovery is it's a science warship to me. And that's what I think I'm seeing. And to be honest with you, when have we ever really seen a Federation warship?
Not much. We saw it in DS9 with the Defiant.
Right.
But this is way different. And you said this is a science warship. That is a perfect thing to call this because it makes text what's always been pretty much subtext in the Star Trek universe. That is Starfleet about exploration and science, or is it about, are they the military? Right? There's always been that tension. And here we're seeing that tension kind of explored very explicitly with, yeah, guess what? We're in a military situation, but our key weapon is this really innovative science. Right. I love that.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't necessarily get a sense that it's a warship, though. I mean, I know that it's in the time of war, mm-hmm. but it seems like their primary focus is science so far. And I'm curious to what extent they are going to be like engaging in battle and being on the front lines.
Well, it's science in the service of war because Lorca said the reason that I have all this carte blanche and the reason we're doing this experiment is because, yeah, it's not a weapon, but if we have the speed to get in and out in an instant, that's going to turn the tide of this war.
But do you get the sense that the Discovery itself is a...
do they have a bunch of cannons? And
narrative-wise, I would anticipate it probably is. But do you get a sense that this is fully battle-ready and they're going to be a frontline?
I mean, we're talking about a ship that has a black alert. A black alert. We've never heard black alert
before. Yeah, that was cool.
I mean, you've got this black alert. You've got this slug bull Robies like monster that you're keeping tied up, which dispatched 12 Klingons without thinking of it. Like, there's a lot going on here. Do I think that they have some torpedoes and some phasers, some cannons, and some the shields are top of the line? Absolutely. I don't think there's a vehicle in Starfleet at currently that could go toe-to-toe with Discovery.
I think we have the potential to see the Discovery not necessarily being a battleship, like to your point, but to being something of a crew of scientific Cold War soldiers or spy soldiers. Like they were not necessarily going to be on the front lines shooting lasers at everybody, but since they have this super fast warping and transporter technology, they can warp in and warp out and really plant traps for the Klingons or do really specific things that can help bring them down. You know, something more interesting than just engaging a ship face to face and shooting lasers.
Okay. Yeah. I think I'm coming around to this
idea. I can see that.
It has to be a warship, like, and it has to be battle ready because why would they even bother putting cutting edge technology in some of their, I'm assuming based on how the script goes, top of the line scientists on this ship? That just seems like too much of a liability in any other aspect.
Yeah, there's no doubt that Discovery can probably take care of itself. I don't think they would place a captain like Lorca in a ship that, you know, probably didn't have some pretty big guns. He seems like a guy who, like, if he was an Old West character, he would be, you know, he would have 2 6-shooters on him at all times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting, though, because if anyone here is a patron, I think you guys should go and listen to our first Patreon episode. You presented a very interesting theory mm-hmm. about Lorca.
I did.
And
before we even met him.
And I'm curious, what are you thinking now? And I don't know if this is appropriate for the main episode, given what you discussed there, but I'm thinking you might have been off base.
Maybe a little, because it was a pretty extreme prediction.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about it on the Patreon, I think. But
okay.
But yeah, I think I'm still leaning that way a little bit.
Patreon.com/StarTrekPod.
Nice promo, man.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, we talked about the ship and we are talking about the characters, but just tell me overall, the way these characters were introduced, what did you think about that? And let's talk about the first major introduction.
Tilly? Was she the first one?
I think it was Lorca, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. Here's my thing with Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
They introduce him in this dark room.
Jason Isaacs. I like that.
And,
the dark
and
room
he's
thing.
Like, I have some weird fucked up thing with my eyes because of aliens, shit, and space, whatever. I don't know what it was.
I have a fortune cookie.
I have a fortune cookie because writers like gimmicks. But
here's the explanation for why it's all dark in here. And the show's going to be shot very darkly, and we have an explanation for it. I like that.
It's going to be dark here, and it takes me a while for my eyes to acclimate to light getting a little bit brighter in rooms. But then I'm just going to warp you into this other room that has different light settings without really checking it and just not even mention this from now on for the rest of the episode. I was like, why have that little thing about his eyes? I don't know.
I think they were really trying to make him come across as intimidating.
Also human. He has a flaw.
That is his flaw. And he's got tradition. And I think that's one thing that we've seen with all the Star Trek captains is they've got this backstory that has this familial tradition, right? With, you know, you think about Picard and having this family that owns this vineyard. Like, they all have these deep things. And here with Lorca, he's got, you know, a family that used to make fortune cookies.
It just
seems weird.
Wait, his family used to make them? I must have missed that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the fortune cookies.
Okay.
That was more of a quick expositional line. Like, this was back when we had commerce and money, and now we don't. But maybe
we're headed back there.
We're headed back there because you started a war, so we don't know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even so, it seems like giving him this light sensitivity eyes handicap is one of those cute, quirky things they do in the first episode. But watch how inconsistent they will be throughout the rest of this series.
It's possible.
With that one little thing, because it was just extra fodder that they don't want to deal with when it handicaps anything else they want to do with the narrative.
I think the other thing that it does give us, though, is a plausible explanation already in episode 3, while Lorca won't be on away missions, right?
Okay.
Because when you think about it, Kirk was always on away missions, right? And now we see, and it looks very different. Like, when you look at Lorca, he looks strong and ready and imposing. And you think that, wow, this is a guy who'd be completely ready to kind of go out and explore. Yet, I think we now understand that he has limitations. Maybe he used to be on away missions, but we've got a reason to already understand why he won't be.
And that would kind of be a reason for why he wants Michael Burnham on the crew, because right away he sent her on an away mission.
He did.
Because he knows she can handle herself.
And she's going to think outside the box, right? Like, he clearly wanted someone who's going to kind of be him out there, right?
See, that's pretty brilliant right there. And Clyde, excellent point on that.
Thank you.
I didn't really. I was like, why would they even handicap this guy? But yeah,
mm-hmm.
He's not going to be going out on missions.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the main protagonist is Michael Burnham, and she reflects a lot of his ideals of what he wants in someone who's, I don't want to say morally flexible, but that is pragmatic over ideological in pursuit of the end game, I guess.
Yeah, I look at it and say what we're seeing, and I think we've seen this from other captains, is this tradition of, I don't want to break the rules, but I'm going to bend them when I think they need to be bent, right? I mean, he's bending them to their right up until their breaking point. But
yeah. Michael straight up broke them.
Right.
And then she's getting a second chance because she's the smartest one in the room. Which was also a hilarious line. I like that Saru goes, she's the smartest person I've ever worked with. And then Lorca goes, yeah, Stamets.
Stamets.
Yeah, Stamets. And you're in the room right now.
I love that. Yeah, and you're in the room too.
I mean, I don't know if you guys did it, but as I was watching this, I was just kind of like, ooh! Mm-hmm.
And sick burn.
Yeah, not quite there. But yeah, but I was just like,
but I think they will continue the handicap. One thing, yeah, you're totally right. You can't go on away missions. And that also sets up, that could possibly set up a dramatic disparity between him and the crew that gets to go on away missions, because he's not there. He's not going to see what they see. He's not going to experience what they experience. So the fact that he can't always be by her side when she goes away, he's going to have to trust her a lot. But, you know, that's also a good recipe for conflict.
So I have a question for you guys. Like, I'm loving the Burnham character. I was expecting, I think because of some of the promotional materials, that we were finding where normally with Star Trek, we follow the captain, right? The captain, we see that it's led by the captain. Mm. Kirk, Sisko, Picard, Janeway, it's kind of Archer, it's always the captain. And now we're looking at Burnham, who I feel like we were kind of told would be the first officer.
Well, she's presented in the first episode as the first officer.
She is the first officer. She's number one. But now...
It's number one is a snarky thing, I bet, now.
Yeah, well, number one is like Saru. A mean
nickname for her. But, oh, hey, number one, because she's not anymore.
Well, it can be.
And I think we still even have... They haven't told us what her rank, if she has a rank, will be. It's fascinating that we're following this character that isn't in the senior command yet.
It seems like it's going to be a redemptive story. She's going to have to earn back those stripes.
I'm really excited to see the redemption story. And I can't wait till people start to really trust her and she becomes the hero. I'm just trying to figure out, is she going to be number one again? Like, is Saru going to get demoted?
I hope not. I like him in that position.
Yeah, and it seems well earned.
Yeah.
Yes. I will say, I like him a lot more in episode 3 than I did episode 1 and 2. It seems like they fleshed his character out a little bit without even trying that hard, right?
The scene of them just munching blueberries as they walk down the hall, and like, it's... You get all that sense of tension between them, which also means like you really feel that scarlet letter of betrayal on Michael Burnham is earned. Like, she spent 6 months time doing her prison. That's enough to like feel the weight of it, at least a bit. And then she comes back out from there and everyone's just like scowling at her, giving her shit. And you get that feeling like, yeah, you messed up. What you did was way worse than what we as the initial viewers might have thought, because everyone is disgusted by you. You're a villain in Starfleet.
Yeah, you did caused the war.
Yeah.
8,000 people dead because of you. Right.
But the fact that like they're just like casually talking and you know there's that underlying tension, I think that's just really strong writing. Mm-hmm. I love the dialogue between them and how it builds up to like how she wants to apologize, but she's struggling to say it, and he's sympathetic for it.
Yeah.
Well, I would take it a step further and say that when she's walking down the hallway with him and people are looking and he's kind of making note, the fact that he offered blueberries to her, right, is this, it's almost like...
Making peace kind of thing.
I wouldn't even say making peace. It's almost like she's a leper and he's willing to touch her, right, in front of everyone. He's like, hey... Here, you can have some of my food. It's kind of a way of saying, look, I know everyone hates you, but I'm gonna show them that you're not completely bad. And, and that's what he gives us throughout the episode.
Because he does have a lot of apprehension towards her. He does say that, I know you're dangerous, so I can't completely trust you. But he does have that care and respect for her. And I think, you know, after all that happened in the first two episodes, and now to see her surprise, to see Saru back on the bridge, it sets the stage for a completely new dynamic where she almost has to prove herself in his eyes that, yeah, I know you want to trust me, and I'm going to earn that trust, which is not where we were at before. We were just like bickering on the bridge with them before. It's a lot deeper now.
So when we see the scene near the end of the episode where the prison ship jettisons back off and Saru's under the assumption that she's on it, we see gills sprout out from the back of his neck that he embarrassingly tries to hide.
Yeah.
What did you guys read into that? Was that he was sad and filled with regret that she was leaving. I mean, that's kind of how I read
it. That would be my initial read on it, but it doesn't jive with the way those tendrils looked.
I mean, that looked almost, like a defense mechanism. Exactly. Like he was aware that she wasn't on it, and now he's like, looking over his shoulder.
I don't think he's psychic.
Oh, no.
I think what it comes down to is
so spidey senses.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, it's like the hair on the back of your neck, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
And we know that his species, they were prey and they can detect danger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that is a way of going, something's wrong.
Okay.
Like, there's something is dangerous to me. And her still being on the ship.
Is a danger.
I mean, he says you're dangerous.
See, that's what I was curious about. Like, because, you know, me seeing this show through her eyes, I want people to come around and start rooting for her again.
Right.
But it's easy for me to go, oh, I forgive you. Because there's no stakes for me in this fantasy world, right? Well, but for him, his friends died. A lot of people he knew died as a result of her actions and the friction between everyone on that ship.
His ship just got a lot more dangerous.
So if he saw that shooting off and his
tendrils, I like that.
Tendrils, his alarm system went off of there's something dangerous going on. I like that as well. It's an interesting interpretation.
What I love about Saru, and I gotta admit, in the first couple episodes, I thought he was just gonna be like this character that was kind of not even the Spock character, but
Sheldon in space.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you nailed it, Mike. But what we see is he is so critical to her reformation, right? Because everyone they've read about her, they've heard about her, and they look at her as the mutineer, the villain. But he knows her as a three-dimensional character.
He worked with her for years.
She was his boss.
Yeah.
Right? And they, like, he really knows her, and he's the only one who can really bring everybody else around. Like, I think it's fascinating. He is a key component to her story going forward.
It's a potentially, like, meaty role, and I'm so glad Doug Jones is finally getting a meaty role.
Oh, you know, man.
He's
so good. Sad that he has put so much prosthetics on, but
again,
he looks so good.
Doesn't it look amazing?
Incredible.
Yeah. I wonder if they are using some, you know, light CGI in his face as well, like they kind of did in the Iron Man movies, where it's like practical and CGI.
I saw a video of them putting his prosthetics on, and I think it's about four pieces. But it's a lot of like rubber and makeup and he puts the full thing on and hand gloves and stuff like that.
I mean, the emotional weight he's able to convey with his eyes and the little motion of his face that he's able to do.
Even his different postures.
I love this character. He's just fascinating.
So do we love Cadet Tilly, played by Mary Wiseman, a new character?
I kind of do.
Yeah?
I thought she was like, at first I was like, I don't know, is this annoying or is it adorable? And I fell on the side of adorable.
I agree. Like, for a character that's almost like completely defined by her tics, somehow I wasn't annoyed. And then I got invested in the fact that she's this cadet who's at the head of her class. And by the time she's saying things like, I'm going to be a captain one day and you're going to see, I was like invested in that. I'm like, I want to see her make the grade and make captain. I'm so invested in watching that.
Her last name is Janeway, correct?
No. What?
No, I'm kidding.
I was like, really?
No. Who she become?
I just got a bone.
Her name is Gretchen Tilly. And I'm fascinated by her. Like you said, Mike, it's interesting because, you know, you take a show like Stargate, particularly Stargate Atlantis, and they have this character on there, Rodney, who was who had tics. And
Rodney's
was
the best.
And yeah, but I found that times he was super annoying and would drive me crazy. She doesn't seem to come across that way, right? I think she's gonna be a good piece. I'm still trying to figure out though.
She's like the Willow from Buffy.
She's the awkward, geeky best friend. And mm-hmm. I mean, we see this very frequently as a male character. But you just mentioned Willow, which is a great reference to like a female character. I like this. And it's a great character to play off of the stony wall, stoic character that Michael Burnham now has to play because of her fall from grace and, you know, just overall her Vulcan sensibilities. And I found that it was this bright, bubbly optimism that just nicely meshes with and drives a lot of how I can anticipate Michael feeding off of that going forward.
And I relate to her a lot because, much like Cadet Tilly, I'm allergic to every goddamn thing and it makes me snore.
I think it's fascinating if you look at her as kind of, I guess she's going to be the sidekick, right?
This may be a little bit of a bummer, but my prediction based on that line of, oh, I'm going to be a captain someday, right? Ooh. That can go one of two ways. Either she's going to become a captain someday or she's going to die in the last episode of the season.
Yeah, they're going to Joss Whedon her.
Isn't that what you do? You
that's you what you do. It's not what you have to do.
Really optimistic note, and then you go, oh, but now it has so much more emotional weight, especially on rewatch.
That is true. However, I think that would be a big loss because this is an opportunity to watch a character grow and progress in some really satisfying ways. We see her as this, you know, wide-eyed cadet, and she's going through war. What is that going to do to a person who's this optimistic? Will her optimism and her goals guide her through, or will she get crushed by it? Like, that's what I want to see. I want to see that old over many years.
Crushed. Wasn't there a Wesley Crusher who went through like the wide-eyed?
Yeah.
Well, but I think, Mike, I think you're absolutely right. You do want to see how she evolves, particularly with what's going on. But I also think that part of what you like about Star Trek is that you want to see people advance, right? The whole idea is that they should, you want everybody to become a captain, right?
The idea is to make ourselves better.
Yes. And individually, when you think about something like TNG, you're looking at that bridge crew and you're thinking, well, yeah, I want all of them to have their own ship one day. And so when you look at someone like Tilly, I'm hopeful and going, yeah, I hope she does have her ship. Now, do I think it's going to be like the flagship? No, I think it's going to be like the USS Never Heard Of. And it's going to be some medical ship or something like that.
USS Ford Fiesta.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be something like think about it. You always hear these random ships and like, oh, they're distress call and we've got to go help them out. I think that's going to be Tilly.
Okay, Paul Stamets, Anthony Rapp. Do you guys like this guy?
Super annoying, but done extremely well. Kudos, Anthony Rapp.
Likeably arrogant, I would say.
Yeah, this character is supposed to come across as abrasive, especially when he's sparring with our lead protagonist, who we are, maybe even begrudgingly, but for me, willingly, you know, enraptured by and rooting for. So for him to kind of play in a way this sort of tight ass heel to her, I loved it. I'm all about this guy. I think that him having the intellect to go toe to toe with her, and him not wanting to be on this ship and losing someone gives a lot of this emotional weight, and I think that he pulled that off pretty well.
Well, talking about Stamets, the whole spores, molds, and fungus thing. That's 100% Brian Fuller. Like, he's credited with the story here. He's one of the writers credited. But did you guys watch Hannibal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a small arc all about, I don't remember what it was, but it had a lot to do with fungus and mushrooms. And it was all based on the work of the real Paul Stamets, who is a real-life mycologist.
Yes.
And I guess that, you know, obviously that's what Anthony Rapp's character is based on.
He's an astromycologist.
Astromycologist.
That's what he calls him.
So you can apparently watch a TED Talk with
apparently Stamets. He's got a great TED Talk.
It's all about how, you know, mushrooms and fungus can change the world and can do a number of different benefits for everyone.
I hate mushrooms, by the way.
He also believes that there are spores that kind of emanate everywhere. So
I love that.
From our planet, there's spores going out and spores are coming to other planets. So the whole idea behind this spore drive, and this is real stuff, this is real tech. The idea behind this spore drive is that you can kind of follow those from point to point.
Is this sort of like a mix of, like, using spores as reference points for, like, quantum entanglement? I wasn't really sure what was going on with how they were able to, like, say, oh yeah, there's spores everywhere, and therefore we can use that and like jump Michael Burnham from place to place to place within that little pod there.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It's definitely a touchstone for something like quantum entanglement. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the risk of getting just lit up on Reddit for bad tech, I do think that that's exactly what we're kind of talking about.
Mm. Okay. Well, I find it fascinating, but there is a bunch of, like you mentioned at the top of the show, technobabble going on here.
But it was good. I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was good, except I was like, wait, I'm not, like, as a newbie, I'm like, is this all stuff that you guys are kind of familiar with? But I have no idea what's going on.
Not necessarily this concept, but, you know, there's always lots of technobabble, but it's really just how do we punch ourselves out of this paper bag we're stuck in this episode? And then, oh, here's how. And it doesn't really, it's not as, you don't get as invested in it as you do here. Here, it's a really complex, interesting mystery. And the fact that the, you know, the stuff that's rooted in technobabble is rooted in something that's real, and it's based on an actual mycologist work. Like, it makes you want to research that stuff and determine how much of this is actually possible.
This is one of those areas, one of the probably few areas, where having the episode on CBS All Access was helpful, because I was able to just go back 30 seconds and hear it again. And there were a couple moments where I had to go back a couple times and go, wait, what did they just say?
I'm watching with closed captions, like, give me the exact words here.
I thought about watching with closed captions.
Oh, I have to all the time.
I do.
Yeah. I don't want to miss the visual, like, just incredibleness.
I need that button at the bottom of the screen. Yeah. That guy might be wearing.
I know we're running long, but speaking of that, no Klingons in this episode.
That's not true. We did see him on the Glenn, on the USS Glenn.
Right. I guess
he,
what I meant to say was
him. He said, yeah,
that's right.
Landry turned around and said, did he just shush you?
Speaking of the USS Glenn, I mean, I feel like first off, we have to touch on that scene, but also, is that named after
John Glenn?
Scott Most Glenn, a.k.a. Stick from Daredevil.
Yeah, well, Dark he Glenn. Was in The Right Stuff.
There you go, yeah, right?
So he absolutely was.
The reason I said there was no Klingons, because in the first two episodes, we got such a deep perspective on the Klingons on the sarcophagus ship. Mm-hmm. Same plot line split down the middle between the Klingons and the humans. I was kind of expecting to see that again, but we didn't.
But they're that running foe in the background now.
Right.
Like, we know that there's a problem. We don't see Vok here.
No.
But we do see other Klingons that obviously tried to jump on this, the USS Glenn, and I guess raid it once they saw that like something wrecked its shit.
Yeah.
But it goes full horror movie, guys. Like, this felt like I was playing the video game Dead Space all of a sudden. That's because you go on there and there's...
It was well done.
Creepy ship, and there's just bodies that have all turned to goo with no bones.
For a second, I was like, okay, is this just going to devolve into like the millionth riff on Aliens? Is that what we're getting to now? I had that feeling for a second, but everything that came before was so good that I was willing to be like, okay, cool. If you want to be Aliens right now, cool. But it was really well done. And like the Cronenberg stuff was something different. And it was pretty damn suspenseful. And I like how she figured out how to save everybody.
Well, yeah. And I think it definitely gave her credibility. Look, I'm the last person who likes space horror, right? Like, I'm usually out every
really?
Time. Yeah, just, you know, whether it's a zombie-infested ship or something.
Like the Reavers.
Yeah. I love Firefly.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's an episode that is heavy Reaver-centric, I'm like, all right, let's just keep watching.
Hmm.
But with this, I was like, all right, I'm kind of in. Like, this is, it's not too much over the top. You know, and the fact that she was kind of running through the kind of Jeffrey's tubes and quoting Alice in Wonderland, I was like, oh, depth. Like, we're really getting to start to understand a little bit more and more about her character.
Difference of opinion time. All right, guys, what was the deal with the Alice in Wonderland reading, saying lines there? I can't stand this stuff. When I see the heavy hand of the writer, when they want to just quote stuff, there was this, there was that Beatles line where he's like, oh yeah, someone who has a cover band, they do Beatles stuff, but he's not John Lennon. I'm like, Okay, that's like having a Beethoven cover band. That's stupid. time difference wise. But also, yeah, the fortune cookies and this, it just felt a little bit too much from the writers. Like they wanted to do something a little bit too cute. Mm. Now, Mike, you had a different opinion, though.
Yeah, I have a good Star Trek explanation or reason for why I like that stuff. Okay. Maybe not the Beatles thing, but the...
I hated the Beatles
thing. Okay, I think everybody hated the Beatles.
Wait. Yeah. Before we just get inundated with mayo.
You like the Beatles.
I like the Beatles.
Me too.
I hated the Beatles reference
in this
episode.
Noted. So the fortune cookie thing, yeah, that was just kind of a... Like I said before, kind of a hand wave exposition of like, we're beyond money and commerce and all that, and we don't want to get dragged back there again because of this war. So that's fine. The Alice in Wonderland thing, you got to think about who Michael Burnham is. She is a human who, for the first few years of her life, had human parents who died. And then all of a sudden, she was stuck on Vulcan, being raised by Vulcan. And Ashley mentioned this a lot last time, being forced to suppress her emotions in any situation. That's who Vulcans are. You get through things with logic. You suppress those emotions because that's the only way you're going to get through tough situations. So here, it makes sense that it is a nerve-rattling situation. She's being chased by this monster in a constricted Jeffrey's tube. She has to keep her shit together. So it makes sense to me that she would have some kind of mantra that she repeats or something that she would go back to that comforts her or that focuses her. The fact that it was Alice in Wonderland is a little hacky. I'll give you that. But the fact that she would go to something that's comforting to her from her childhood to keep herself focused in a situation like that made sense to me.
And I think what helped me with it, they brought it back. So at the last scene...
I do appreciate that.
You know, we're seeing...
You have a book?
Right. And then we get to hear a little bit about this foster mom and, you know, the only person to speak and their son... I got to know more about this. Like, I've got to know more about
this. Do you guys know who this Amanda lady, known only as Amanda?
That's Spock's mom, man.
Is it?
Yeah. It's Spock's mom. They've already cast her, too.
So Amanda, Spock's mom, also took care of her, as well as Spock's dad. So she's, like, totally tight with Spock?
Probably, because she... Didn't she mention that Amanda would read this to me and her son? Yeah.
She's supposed to be older than Spock just a little bit, right?
I think so.
Yeah, but they're close in age. So
Mia Kirshner is going to play her.
Is Spock half human?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, his mom's a human.
That's his conflict. He doesn't know if it's his human half or his Vulcan half ever.
Right. Yeah. Hey, so I get the expert baton now. You didn't there know you Spock go. Was half human.
It's something that I will be honest... I remember knowing that at some point, but I forgot.
Yeah. I remember she was a Winona Ryder in the movie. Okay, so overall, this was a very controlled, sophisticated mix of plot and character-driven story. Mm-hmm. I think it was a really good episode. It was nerdy as hell without being boring, which was great. Something Star Trek doesn't always pull off very well. And it's got me hooked on this show. More, please. Are we all kind of in agreement here?
Yeah. Definitely. Right. I need more.
Okay. Anything else we want to say before we move on to questions?
No, bring on the questions.
All right. Okay, so we got some listener questions on our Facebook page. And listener, if you want to contact us, just go to StarTrekPod.com. Click on that Facebook link, click on that Twitter link, engage with us that way. So Kyle Volte says, so given the fact that internationally, Discovery is available through more traditional methods like Netflix in the UK or Space in Canada, how do you feel about the decision by CBS to hitch their streaming wagon to the show?
I mean, business-wise, it makes sense. They want to be a competitor with all these other platforms, and they were the ones that were holdouts, and that's probably because they were the top dog among the networks. I mean, CBS has been king shit for a while because old people are the ones who still keep cable, And that's why, and they have shows like Big Bang Theory and CSI that people just gobble up, right?
Yep.
But what they need is if they were going to try and get anyone to buy into another online platform, they need a tentpole show. And their best bet is this Star Trek one. It completely makes sense. And given the quality of product that they're putting out, it's not necessarily the worst online viewing platform that you could buy into.
I don't begrudge them much at all for doing this. For it makes business sense, like you said. But also, like we saw today, if this was on regular CBS, we probably wouldn't have seen the horror that was those Cronenberg people, mm-hmm. which really added this extra layer of threat and darkness to the episode that made it really intriguing. You know, so yeah, you have the space to push your content into some more explicit or darker boundaries if the story wants it to go there.
I see what you did there with space.
So one of the
I did that.
One of the things that I've been kind of researching recently is what the networks are trying to do, and particularly when you think about like Amazon, Hulu, and Netflix. One of the things that they're struggling to do is everybody wants a Game of Thrones. Like, that's the gold standard right now. They want a show that brings an audience, that gets acclaim like Game of Thrones. Everybody's looking for it. Netflix thought they had it with Marco Polo, and they were way wrong. And so I think what you're looking at with CBS is they've got this show. Now, Mike, to your point, if they're looking for their Game of Thrones, they can't put it on CBS. Mm-mm. Like, you can't have that show on CBS, because you're not going to be able to go dark when you need to go dark, do some of the imagery and language that you want to go. You're not going to be able to do it.
However, I do not anticipate them ever showing nudity on this show, and I don't anticipate like just straight on gore, and I don't anticipate like expletives.
Really. No, the F word's coming. They've said the F word.
Oh, she's Michael Burnham said shit in this episode.
Yeah, they have not ruled out nudity, and the F word's coming.
The fuck you say?
Well, if I have to pay $10 a month for the potential of Saru sex, I'm down.
Hey,
I want to see that.
Yeah, just like
I'm not quite ready to go to 10, but I will do 6 and deal with the commercials.
Hey, Saru, no commercials.
Fuck long and prosper, my friend.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so Jonathan Huffnagel, who I think you're familiar with, Grant.
Hey, Jonathan Huffnagel.
He says, "Good evening, Discovery Pod crew. You are okay. Here's his question: You are now the captain of your own ship. What is the name of your starship? What aliens are part of your bridge crew? Where would you go first? What trouble of the week do you run into? How do you save the day, or do you?" I got this. I'm ready. Can I go?
Please do.
Okay, all right. My starship is the starship Familia. My helmsman is Dom from the planet Toretto. My science officer is Ramsey from the planet Haxalot. And my security officer is Letty, also from planet Toretto. We would ride or die into space, dusting any Make Kronos Great Again Klingons with our nitrous-powered warp engines.
You would warp fast and you would warp furious, my friend.
Yes, we would.
Well, could your ship go more than a quarter mile? Or would you just focus on a quarter mile at a time?
That's how that's how I would live my Star Trek life.
Oh, man. I don't know if I could even top that.
Ride
I have
or die.
No,
that's it. That
possibly.
Is it.
Ride or die.
That's perfect.
Okay. I just want to read one 5-star review. We have a bunch of them, and we'll kind of spread them out through each podcast. So Solstice said, "This should be considered required listening for fans of the series. Solid podcast from a creator of another fantastic podcast I've enjoyed greatly. 5 stars. Thanks. Leave us a 5-star rating review on Apple iTunes. Go to StarTrekPod.com. Click on that Apple iTunes link. Subscribe. Leave a review. Or if you have iOS 11, just tell Siri, subscribe me to Star Trek Discovery Pod.
5 stars. Don't even skimp.
Okay, so remember to listen to our bonus podcast over at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Drop us a buck an episode, help us keep the mics running, and subscribe to the podcast. And for more great TV podcasts, visit our podcast network, Permanent Record, at permanentrcrd.com. What's the name of that network again?
Permanent Record.
All right. Guys, you want to let people know where they can find you online?
You just go to Permanent Record. You'll see me pop up over there.
Yeah, I'm at Permanent Record. This is Clyde. But you can also find me on TV Pilot Watching, where we talk about first run premiere shows. And also, if you're a fan, and I don't know how many Star Trek fans are also fans of the NBC show This Is Us, we've got a This Is Us podcast as well. This Is Us with Key and Clyde.
It's a great show, guys.
And you can find me at Mike Moody on Twitter. Live long and prosper.
Fuck long and prosper.